our thing we already discussed. The FaceTime, they talked about FaceTime a bit, and then they talked about CarPlay. And I got to tell you, I'm really excited about the look of new CarPlay and perhaps the best couple of features. Number one, tapbacks in CarPlay. I don't know what the UI affordance is for that. They showed it for a flash, so I don't know how I could do a tapback in
Go ahead,
CarPlay.
Dingus, give that a thumbs up.
Maybe, I don't know. Pinned conversations and messages is really nice because there's occasions. I mean, obviously, Aaron and I send texts back and forth all day long, even though we're in the same house together. But there's occasions I'll be in the car and she has fallen off the most recent, like 10 conversations or whatever. And it's much more burdensome to say, hey, Dingus, send a message to my wife. What do you want it to say? Well, tell her, blah, blah, blah. And so, anyways, having her always up at the top is excellent. Widgets and live activities are, I am in full support of this, although I don't know that that's a need that I have in the car specifically, but I dig it. iPhone widgets work in CarPlay, which is cool. They also plugged CarPlay Ultra. They said the first vehicles with CarPlay Ultra just launched last month. I
So,
presume
was
they.
there more than one Aston Martin
I
SUV?
think they just mean that there's more than one copy of the Aston Martin that has been sold.
They
I
have
genuinely
sold
think.
three of them.
Right,
Yeah,
exactly.
so weird, but yeah. Anyway, and when they showed the interior with the new look with CarPlay, I think it has a better chance of matching more cars' interiors. We talked about that when we talked about CarPlay Ultra, like this sort of Fisher-Price candy-colored iOS 7 CarPlay next to the, the punch-through of the seat adjustment in the Aston Martin. They didn't match styles. This kind of glassy translucency, the companies that design their own car interfaces love this stuff. They love gradients, they love translucency, so maybe this will be a better match for more other manufacturers' UI.
Yeah, and it's funny because they said, and this should be an almost verbatim quote, this is just the start of the CarPlay Ultra journey with many more brands around the world looking to bring this experience to market. Combining the marquees or the manufacturer's unique look and feel with the power of iPhone, which here again, I think what they're nodding in the direction of, you don't have to make it look 100% like Apple. You can do your own
Just
thing.
50%.
Just 50%. And before we move on, I just wanted to point out that they did say, and I didn't get a chance to write down the quote, but they said that when a call comes in, for example, it doesn't take over the entire friggin' screen, because that's the most annoying thing in the world is when you're driving and you have the map view up and you're trying to, navigate, and then somebody calls you and you can't see your map anymore. It's infuriating. And now they have like a little toast style thing that pops up. I am here for that. Then Darren Adler came in to discuss communication and whatnot. They talked about how they did change the look of the phone app. There's now call screening, which I presume is opt-in, but it can automatically answer calls from unknown numbers, and it'll like triage that, and it will ring through to your phone. Like the phone won't actually ring until the caller has identified themselves and tells the phone why they're calling, which I'll believe that if I see it, but in
I mean, don't
principle,
you
I
all
dig
kind
it.
of do that today? When I'm curious, I'll do the thing where like you let it pick up the voicemail and you see
Yes.
the little text going, right? This
Yeah,
is just more
I
like
do.
automating that process even further for you.
Hold assist, which again, tentatively very excited. We'll see what it's like in reality. But the theory here is that if you're on hold, the iPhone will detect the Muzak that's playing and it will let you do other things and even effectively hang up the phone, not literally hang up the phone, but effectively hang up the phone. And then once a live, and this is now a quote, once a live agent becomes available, we'll ring you to return to the call and let the agent know you'll return shortly. This is kind of really obnoxious, and I'm so here for it because, oh my gosh, when you have to wait on hold for an hour, it's infuriating. And you know what? I think this is a pretty
All right,
great
well,
idea.
so now, I mean, this is maybe a wonderful moment in time where we'll have this tool that will help us, but you realize this is an arms race because now, so what this is doing is like there'll be a computer voice saying, "Just a moment, Casey Liss will be back here in a moment. We're ringing him now because you've left him on hold for an hour." It'd be great if they said that to the person, but those people aren't having it. But anyway, those people can also deploy a system. It's like, well, we're not going to bother our operators until we know that we have a live person. So it's their robot talking to your robot about who's going to be back when and who's going to be called when. And you're hoping at some point both of them will agree to ring the actual humans and connect them on the call. Yes, not. But anyway, I endorse this because this is a tool for the world that we live in. The world that we live in, sometimes you got to be on hold for a long time and you can't just be sitting there listening to their terrible, like, overdriven clipping Muzak from whatever decade, interspersed with a message that says your calls are important to them, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Messages get some new treats. I'm an old, so I don't care. They get backgrounds. They get group chats, including polls, which actually could be kind of cool.
Yeah, polls will be useful. That's cool.
Request send and receive cash. Again, that could be useful. What I'm really digging is typing indicators for group chats, including who is typing. I'm here for that. You can also screen unknown senders when it comes to messages, which is cool. Then we've got Leslie Okamoto, who comes out, who talks about images and how you can mix emoji and make images using ChatGPT within the Image Playgrounds app.
This is a theme of the sort of sprinkle throughout the rest of the thing is we have a feature that we introduced last year that's not that great. We've slightly improved it. Hopefully it's better. But by the way, we know we suck, so just let ChatGPT do this. Because honestly, image generation, like if you've tried to use their image playgrounds or Genmoji and tried to get it to do something, you either luck out and it's one of the easy things that it can do, or it's hopeless. You will never get it to do what you want. But ChatGPT image generation is amazing, and hopefully they're exposing the latest and greatest version of that. Don't even bother asking image playgrounds to make your image for you. If you want a Studio Ghibli-ified version of a picture of yourself, just ask ChatGPT. It'll do it in 2 seconds, setting aside all of the intellectual property and artistic concerns, which are beside the point. In terms of just the quality, ChatGPT can do this better. And Apple, everywhere in their OS, is like, we will not be able to get better enough to do at doing this, to announce this as WWDC 25. So please add a backdoor, side hatch, escape hatch, so that they can use ChatGPT. And I hope they do this in a way where you're not getting some babyified ancient version of ChatGPT that's not really good at it, or there are tons of guardrails or whatever. Because we've seen that before, where asking ChatGPT correctly produces an amazing result, but asking through Apple's intermediary does not. And I think what they said on this and all the other features is like, yeah, when you do this, we're sending your query to ChatGPT, and if you upload an image, we're sending that image to them. And like, they didn't make as strong a privacy thing. They just said, look, you have to opt into this. So you are choosing to do this, but there's kind of no getting around the fact that you will be sending your data to OpenAI. And if you don't want to do that, don't use this feature.
Yep. They made mention of the fact that you can do different image styles like oil painting, realistic image, et cetera, which they explicitly did not allow in the prior version of the Image Playgrounds. And additionally, there's an Image Playground API, which I thought there was at least a modicum of it in the past, but apparently there's either more or new API this year. Live translation, which I really dig. You can translate conversations on the fly. This is integrated into messages, FaceTime, phone, et cetera. It's 100% on device. The words are translated as you talk, and they're spoken out loud for the call recipient. They did some demos of this, and to their credit, it did not appear to be sped up because the latency looked like crap, yeah, if I'm honest with you, but I respect that.
To their credit, yeah, because like if they were going to speed it up, they would have sped it up from that.
They would have, yeah, because it looks slow. Well, here's the thing about this. I love this. I love this being like a system-level thing that's everywhere. And being on device, you know, like the latency is not network latency. It is just like, look, this is how long it takes. But the thing about live translation models is the gigantic ones that you can't run on your phone are just better. And this is the type of like natural language of real-time translation. It's the type of thing that I really wish I would actually love to year after year get just the most monstrous model to do the translation for me that's not running on my phone, because the data you're sending back and forth, it's low volume of data. It's latency sensitive, so that's true, but you're sending text. Like the only thing you care about is like the round trip time, but there's not going to be sort of any upload or download time. It seems to me that Google is way ahead on this in terms of the sophistication of the translation. I've already seen a couple people posting online about how people who spoke both of the languages saying this translation isn't that great, but like the fact that it's there at all is the important thing. If you need it in a pinch, if you're in a foreign country, if you're talking to somebody who you don't understand their language, you want them to understand you, you'll take anything that kind of gets the point across. And so I love that this is there, but like doing it all on device really feels like one of the things I would look for from Apple is like, I want the best translation in the world. And if I have a good network connection, do that. Fall back to your local model if you have to, but just give me the best. Like, I would even consider paying for that, because of the gap between like not particularly sophisticated auto translation and the world's best is pretty big at this point.
Nevertheless, I respect that they're doing it. I respect they didn't speed it up, etc. Then we get Kathy Lynn to talk about Apple Music. There's lyrics translation, lyrics pronunciation, which is cool if you're listening to something in a foreign language. There's auto mix, which also sounded pretty cool, where it'll seamlessly go from one song to the next, you know, similar to what a DJ would do, including using time stretching and beat matching. I think that's neat. Music pins for things you want to listen to frequently. I like that. Maps gets to learn your preferred routes, and it'll let you also search visited places. That sounds really useful to me. Like, oh, where did I get a bagel a few weeks ago? And I don't remember the name of that place was, but I know I went there. If this works, then I think that would be really great.
Oh, both these things, by the way, music pins and visited places. It amazes me how long it has taken to Apple to get around to these things, but I'm so glad they have. Like, most third-party apps are much better about this. Recognizing, kind of like you recognize that not every button on the face of a controller is used with equal frequency, recognizing when you're in an app, like, you're probably going to use one of your top two or three playlists way more often than the others. You're probably in messages going to message the same handful of people way more than all the other words. The UI should reflect that. Same with when we visited places. Yes, there's a search field. You can search for stuff. But what you're probably interested in is someplace you might have been before. So privilege that in the UI. Allow someone to pin the things that they use frequently. Give a special place of privilege to places that people have been before because they're highly likely to go there again, more likely than, say, every other place on the earth that they haven't been. And that's just basic, obvious information hierarchy and customization. And yet it's taken 26 versions of iOS, not really, to get to that point. So kudos for them for finally adding it, but it's like, oh, geez, I'd almost given up even wanting to, and there is a way to pin playlists now, but like more prominently have a giant button up there that's like, yes, this is the playlist I use all the time, top left, love it, add it to every app, please.
Then we've got wallet, where they talked about car keys, driver's licenses, etc. Apparently boarding passes are getting better, which I'm excited about. This is the first Sherlocking that I saw. They said they're going to be live, shareable live flight statuses. I joked in the show, in our internal show notes, RIP Flighty. Flighty is an amazing app that does a lot more than just this, but it is a shot across the bow, nevertheless.
And what it is, it's raising the bar for the, like, Flighty is for people who really care about and either fly a lot or really care about the details because it is just best in class. But what this does is someone who is never going to pay for Flighty, it gives them a baseline level of functionality that people aren't getting now, like live activities for your flight, shareable flight status, like every flight tracking app has that in it. But now this is something that just comes with the OS. And I think that's appropriate. Like what comes with the OS should be baseline level of pretty good. And if you are a quote unquote pro user of flying or whatever, like then you step up to a third party app. And so I don't think it's a Sherlocking at all. And like, I honestly, for people who like fly very rarely, it's almost impossible to convince them to pay for something like Flighty because it is kind of like a premium expert level product. They just want the basics. And now it's built into their phone. I give this a big thumbs up.
Yep. And then they talked about Apple Pay, where you can use like point redemption, not only or installments. And I guess you could already do that online, which I've never
personally
done.
But now you can do
it
when you pay, yeah.
But now you can do it in person. Additionally, they're getting order tracking beyond just Apple Pay orders. And I got to tell you, I have only seen this myself like once or twice so far, but with stuff that I've ordered with Apple Pay where, you know, you get the order tracking information in the wallet app. I almost never see this personally, but apparently this is going to go beyond just Apple Pay orders and they're going to sniff through your email and try to find, you know, that sort of information, which I think is cool. So again, jokingly, I said RIP parcel in our internal show notes. And here again, I don't think it's quite that simple, but it's still a quasi-Sherlocking to a small degree.
And the complication here with any of these things is like, okay, we'll go through your email to figure this out. Where do you think my email is, Apple? It's not an Apple mail. Oh, well, never mind then. Right. You know, yeah. Like like all of these things, like the Google's been implementing this feature for years, but they want your mail to be in Gmail. Otherwise, they can't see your mail as easily or at all. And so, yeah, this is these sort of context-aware things. I wish they weren't so siloed, but just the nature of the beast these days.
Yeah, there's bunch of features like this that Apple adds every year that are like, you know, kind of boil the ocean problems of like, well, if we can get a whole bunch of, you know, different people and companies and sometimes governments and some of these features on board with our system, this will be great. And they have, you know, a mixed track record of actually doing that. Sometimes the things they do that way do work out. Usually there has to be a decent incentive for the other party, you know, or parties to do it. And a lot of the things are like, we have a brand new, like you were saying earlier, John, about the web stuff. Like, you know, we're going to declare a new CSS property to fix this layout bug on the iPhone.
And every web page will update.
Right. It's like, you know, if it's like we've declared a new standard. It's superior to all the other standards because it's private and it's secure and it only works on our devices. But it's going to be great as long as we get all these different companies or whatever to participate. Those have a much higher miss rate. So it's great when they hit, or it's great like if they hit in a way that like the app or service or whatever that you use happens to work with it. Great. But a lot of these features we kind of have to view through the lens of like, well, that might be great like in 10 years when it gets adoption, if ever. But, you know, maybe not necessarily anytime soon.
My impression with the order tracking is they're doing what Google does, which is we will look at your entirely unstructured, probably HTML email, and we will rummage through it and try to find things that we think are information about orders. And then we will extract that information from totally unstructured text data and turn it into a parcel alert type thing. Google's been doing, again, for years. Google does a pretty good job of looking at any old email. And these companies that are sending you messages about your orders aren't in cooperation with Google. In fact, many of them, like Amazon, intentionally started omitting information from their emails so they didn't want Google to know what you were ordering because they used that to sell ads against, and there was this whole battle and blah, blah, blah. I'm assuming that's what Apple is doing, that there is no standard that anyone needs to comply to. Apple will just rummage through your email, which is totally unstructured, and they'll figure it out. And I trust Google much more than Apple to successfully extract order information from unstructured emails, just because they've been doing it for years and years, and this is not Apple's strength. But it does. I think it does rely on you using Apple Mail, because otherwise Apple doesn't have access to your mail. So there's that.
And then we move on to gaming with Ann Tai. Apparently, over 500 million people play games on the iPhone, and they've announced a new games app, which is the new destination to help you get more out of your games. Apparently, the app itself works with a controller, if I understood the keynote right, which is kind of cool. And they talked a lot about how you can play games together, including first player games. But I kind of zoned out during this portion, so I didn't catch the specifics. I don't know if either of you did. But in principle, it sounds good. So
yeah, this is a boil the oceans thing like Marco was talking about. As long as game developers use our new APIs, and it's like you can't even get them to make games for your platform that aren't just ports. Like to use the custom phone platform APIs to do things like challenges and leaderboards. If there's any kind of game that has it's not iOS only, they already have their own system for that. They're not going to incorporate your thing. Like it's more so on the Mac that it's like pulling teeth to get them to port the game at all. But on iOS, even though a lot of games are made for iOS, so many games, they're made for at the very least iOS and Android, and some of them are just cross every platform, and those games are never going to use any of these Apple APIs, because if they want this feature, it has to work on PC, on game consoles, on iOS, on Android, and they're never going to port to the Mac.
I mean, some of this, so, okay, the games app, like, so one thing that struck me about it is that it actually is useful, even, like, you know, I just launched it on my beta phone, which is full of games that don't support it because it just came out and these games haven't updated yet, of course, because they can't yet. And it actually does have value in the sense that, like, it is basically like a games launcher and games promotion area. The question for me, so, okay, it's designed a lot like the TV app where, okay, here's the latest games. You can continue playing the games you played most recently.
Is that buried three screens down to continue playing the game you played? No. But here's some new games you might want to play instead.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know they're going to do that. But no, I mean, no, right now it is above the fold, but it's near the bottom of the fold. And there's, you know, a huge promo slot above. Again, it's just like the TV app, the same kind of design. So it's like, oh, I'm ready to sit down and play a game. Let me go into the games app. Who's going to do that? That's my question. It's like, not that they didn't make a totally decent looking app here that looks just like all of their other like content browsing apps, but are phone users going to open up the games app?
They're
going to
launch the app that
games?
Launches the app.
Right, I don't understand who's going to open this. Like, it's nice that, you know, they basically have, you know, it's basically Game Center, right? They basically took Game Center, made it nicer, made it modern. You know, you have like leaderboards with your friends. I did like the idea of the like score challenges with friends, even in single player games. I think that's a cool little thing.
I mean, I think all that stuff existed previously in Game Center as well. It's probably the same APIs, right?
I don't know. It certainly some of that, at least some of it did. But you know, the new app again, it's nice. It's polished. It looks exactly like the TV app, but not that different from the App Store.
At least it doesn't look like green felt.
Right. But like, I don't understand who is going to like keep this on their front page of their phone and launch this before launching Candy Crush or whatever. Like, I think people who play iPhone games dedicate space on their home screen to put the game icons directly there instead of adding a different tap to open up another kind of heavy, slow app. By the way, like if you navigate the bottom of the games app right now, it's so rough. It has the new tab bar. It's really sluggish. The animations are, again, unhinged, like so over the top, like ridiculous navigating on this tab bar. It's super, like it lights up when you tap it. Like you get anybody out there.
Does it have RGBs?
Yeah, if you have this beta installed on a device, open up the games app and just navigate between those tabs. It shows you right there, like, oh, this tab bar design could use some editing. But anyway, yeah, it's a fine app. I just don't think people are going to actually use it.
I'm kind of disappointed that the long shot rumor that they were going to bifurcate the App Store into games versus non-games, and this would be the games App Store, like, basically end up being like Steam, where this is the place where you go to find the games, buy the games, download the games, install, you know, like, but they didn't do that bifurcation, so instead it's just like Game Center, but not as embarrassing looking.
Yeah, like, if they actually did that, if they actually, like, took games out of the App Store and put them only in games.app, I could maybe see that, but, like, even that, like, you know, I have, what is this NFC app that's showing up in my, like, I think it's not...
Someone miscategorized their own app.
Yeah, like, it kind of depends on, like, the categorization in the App Store, too. Like, what, you know, it raises the question, like, what is a game? And there are a lot of apps that are kind of, like, in between, like, or kind of, like, vague as to, is this a game or is this an app? So it raises a bunch of weird little challenges like that. But, again, I think it's a totally fine set of Game Center evolved functionality. I don't think people are going to actually use it.
We got some discussions about visual intelligence from Billy Sorrentino. I didn't really get this, to be honest with you, but the idea is the same thing with visual intelligence, if I'm not mistaken, is where you could mash down on the camera control on the newer phones and take a picture of something in front of you in the real world and basically ask, what is this? And now you can do that using the screenshot button gesture thing. So you can take a screenshot and you can, you know, basically ask your phone, where can I buy this great jacket? Or you can scribble over like the little part of the image that you're interested in and say, search for similar images online. And I guess that's useful, but that's not something I can imagine ever doing. However, they did point out that if you take a picture of like a poster that has event information, it will suggest that you add that event to your calendar, which that I am very here for. And there's also ChatGPT integration. And this is where the first time I recall them saying, App Intense, baby, App Intense, App Intense. You should look into App Intense. Did I tell you the good word about App Intense? Do you know what I am doing right now? I am intending to tell you about App Intense. It's all about App Intense, as we all expected.
Yeah, this is like kind of another one of these half measure features. They're not what we want is the thing that they showed last year, which is why should I have to take a screenshot and feed it to the thing and go into this modal thing? Shouldn't it be able to just say, hey, dingus, like, find this thing for me, or where can I buy this lamp? And it will find the lamp in the image. It knows what's on my screen. Like, the whole thing of manually making you take a screenshot and going into a mode and scribbling over the thing you want and then potentially firing out the ChatGPT because Apple's own stuff can't do what you want. It's a very manual process. It's like on the slope from, like, we always talk about with chatbots, like, you could do your own web searches, open a bunch of pages and tabs, read all those pages, synthesize the information in your head and come up with the result, or you can have an LLM do all of that for you and just go to ChatGPT and say, give me the X, Y, and Z, and it tries to do it and hopefully does something similar to what you did by saving you time or whatever, right? This is like, we can't yet do that on the phone. Android does a much better job of this, is closer to this than we are. We would like to be able to say, activate our voice assistant and say whatever it wants. It knows what's on your screen. It knows what app you're in. It knows all the app intents that are exposed on your screen. It knows all this stuff. You can just talk to it and it will do it. They don't have that. So they said, well, you used to be able to do it with the camera and say, here's an image, do this. Now you can do what's on the screen, but first you have to take a screenshot, and then you might need to annotate that screenshot, and then you might decide what thing do you want to do. Do you want to ask a question about it, or do you want to do an image search, and do you want to do it with the Apple thing, or do you want to do ChatGPT? That's a lot of taps. But I'm glad they give the ChatGPT backdoor. I hope, again, that backdoor is at least as useful as launching the ChatGPT app, feeding it the screenshot you just took and asking it the same question there. But we shall see.
Yeah, this honestly, I'm more optimistic about the two of you on this feature. I think this, the simple version of what they showed, I think, is very powerful right there. Like, you know, the simple thing of like, oh, here's a text about an event, screenshot it and, you know, make this account or thing. It's basically a really advanced, what used to be called data detectors. But, you know, so we have that. That sounds great. And then also the kind of, you know, pluggable system made by the app intents of like, well, you can like have, if somebody screenshots, you know, a photo of, I don't know, a podcast.
You can say, find this on eBay for me. Like, specifically, yeah. Don't just search the web for it, but, like, I want to buy this on eBay specifically, and eBay exposes an app intent that will launch you into the native app with the search and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I can see this becoming something over time that we use all the time and that actually ends up being incredibly, just incredibly valuable in little ways throughout the rest of our lives using iOS devices.
Yeah, but it's just halfway there. Like, why do I have to initiate the screenshot? It's already on the screen. You're the phone. Like, just do it.
All right, and then we moved on to watchOS, which wasn't that much there, although what was there I thought was really good. This was presented by Stephanie Puslewhite. They said they're going to have a workout buddy, which I thought was Anya from Fitness Plus, but I think it's actually Sam. But anyways, this is a dynamic generative voice that's using voice data from one of the Fitness Plus trainers, like I said, that will give you just the right encouragement. I dig this as an idea. I'm not sure the execution is there, but I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt.
They did say you get to pick from voice assistants or from the voice things. What they didn't say is you can pick from the one that's really perky that you want to kill and the one that's more chill. And like, but again, some people want like the most enthusiastic thing possible and some people don't. And so I bet kind of like Carrot Weather, where you can turn up and down the snark.
Yeah.
Best case scenario, they give you choices of things. I think it's a good feature. I think it's a good feature, yeah, as long as it's optional and as long as you get to pick. Because some people really benefit from having someone encourage them in their ear about, you just did your fastest mile, you're blah, 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 keep going. And some people will want something much more tame, but they do actually want to know, like, you know, good job. Like, that was your third workout this week. That would be like the Carrot Weather turn dial all the way down. It said a fact. You ran three times this week. That was your third run. That may be the level people want. They want to hear somebody tell them that was your third run this week. They don't want to hear, that's so great, that's your third run. And, it, you know, like, but, you know, let the person pick. So I give this feature a tentative thumbs up, not knowing what any of the voices sound like except for the one that they did in the picture, but
sure.
In the video. But I think the one in the video will definitely work for some people.
Yep, I agree. There's better smart stack stuff. They said something about volume, which I totally missed. There's a wrist flick gesture. So if you're looking at the face of the watch and flick your wrist away, that does something. It was unclear to me what
the volume thing is. They're going to dynamically adjust the volume of dings and like audible alerts, yeah, yeah, on the watch based on your surrounding.
Thank you.
So not embarrass you quite as much when you're in like a quiet room and it goes, yeah, ding.
Right.
For the people who have sound on their phone, on their watch, which boggles my mind, but, you know, yep, different strokes.
Yeah, and the, yep, wrist flick gesture was to dismiss notifications, silence alarms, and dismiss the smart stack.
Oh, thank you.
Which is not that different. So the double tap gesture is more of a, like, yes, confirm, open thing, and so
it's
the wrist
like
flick is more
escape
of a cancel or, yeah, exactly.
And then they're apparently doing a pretty good job across all the platforms. I mean this genuinely. I'm not trying to snark. They're doing a good job of keeping parity with at least some of the features, like messages, for example. So you're getting live translations, conversation backgrounds. New actions are being offered, like share my location on Find My. Also, Notes is coming to the Apple Watch, which sounds silly, but I actually am here for. I dig,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
Yeah. I mean, I have probably way too many notes, so I don't know how the search affordance is going to be, or maybe it's just going to be the few most recent notes. But either way, I'm excited about that. Then we got tvOS, which basically amounts to, hey, let me tell you about all the good Apple TV Plus stuff that's coming. Oh, and we did some things. Moving
see,
on.
See, again, if you're going to have an ad for your TV shows, put it in the Apple TV Plus. That's all, yeah, I'm saying. Like, I allow them to say we have a bunch of new shows coming out. Here they are. At least it didn't last that long.
Well, and again, tvOS, like, there actually are some, there's one massive great new feature the automatic sign-in API.
All right.
Well, I disagree.
How many years have we heard that Apple is going to fix the sign-in problem on Apple TV? This could be the year. Every year could be the year. But, man, we've been burned before because this is the main problem with tvOS, especially if you are suckers like we are and buy a new one every single year when they – or not every single year. Every time they come out with a new one, we buy them, which means we have probably more experience than most people with setting up new Apple TVs, and re-signing into all your streaming apps is just like – pulling teeth. It's not like watching paint dry because it's painful, like pulling teeth. And every 5 or so years, they say, we've solved it. You're not going to have to do that again. We're centralizing the sign-in, and we'll just get everyone to work, and it'll sign you in, and everything will be synced, and we're like, this will be great. And then we try it, and it turns out two apps adopted, and they're not the two apps that you use, and you have to spend an hour signing in. So try number 3, 4, automatic sign-in API. This time, for sure, I hope they do it because I hate signing in, and I wish they would fix this, and it has gotten better over time, mostly through them allowing you to use your phone and your own iCloud keychain to do it from your phone. But still, that's so painful. Please, please let this be the year that it really, really solves the problem, because this is a big problem that needs to be solved.
Yeah, but again, it depends on all the apps buying in and updating to use it. And how if you look around at the group of streaming service apps on the Apple TV.
And how much they love Apple.
Yeah. How many of them seem like they care a lot about like fine details of user interface design and
or like doing anything to help Apple, which competes with them with its own streaming service.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like this is part of Apple's problem of basically declaring war on the entire world at various times, is that like these companies don't want to help Apple out. And so like something like this, like it would be great if they all adopt this, but I think odds are low.
I agree. However, I disagree with you saying this was the one good feature. This is good if you're someone who uses profiles. We are not yet that family. Maybe we will be.
You will be.
But the thing that really got me excited, even though this is not a need that I actually have myself, is permanently connect to any speakers. So my understanding is if you had AirPods, if you had HomePods, you could say to the Apple TV some way, somehow, the particulars don't really matter, I always want the Apple TV to play through this one or two HomePods. And that was the only way you could do it. If you had an AirPlay speaker, you could selectively, every time you start the Apple TV, go in and say, please use this AirPlay speaker for the purposes of playback. But then as soon as the Apple TV suspends, it would disconnect or forget that. And now, if we're to believe the keynote, you can say some way, somehow, always, 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 when I'm playing something on the Apple TV, AirPlay the audio to such and such speaker. And that's really exciting for the three people that need it. Now, I'm not even one of them, but I'm excited for all three of you. All right. If you'll permit me, which you won't, but I'm going to try, let's skip macOS, do visionOS, and then let's come back to macOS and iPadOS, because those are the big ones. So since you haven't interrupted me yet, visionOS was done by Mike Rockwell. We got some new experiences. Happy birthday to Underscore. There's a widgets app in widgets kit, so I'm sure Underscore is going to be very happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, you can remember where your apps, or it will remember where your apps are, including widgets, even across restarts. And I think if I understood the implication here, I think what they're saying is if you have a room in the house where you're typically using the Vision Pro or typically doing work or what have you, the way it works today is you can arrange where everything is and put a Slack window over to your left and Safari in front of you and Pages to the right or what have you. But the moment you take the Vision Pro off, that's largely forgotten. Or at best, if you put it back on, they will appear relative to your head in roughly the same spots, but that may or may not be what you want. And if I understand them right, I think what this is saying is Safari will always be, or what did I say, Pages will always be to the right of you, about 5 feet away from that specific wall. In other words, they are going to stay stationary. I cannot talk. They're going to stay stationary in 3D space, and that will be persistent across restarts, I think is what they're saying.
Yeah, at least the widgets are. I don't know if the apps are doing that too.
I thought they said that, but maybe I misunderstood.
Yeah, I think they said the apps as well. Although it's got to be like somewhat like constrained, because if you're sitting at your desk, yeah, everything will be in the same place. But if you're in the same room, but say at a different desk across the room, will that remember a second set of things?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Like, because if you sat down at that desk, you turned it on, all your windows are behind you at the other side of the room. That's not useful.
Yeah. But I mean, in principle, I like this in theory anyway. Then we got Haley Allen to come up and talk about spatial stuff, including you can have spatial scene, spatial browsing in your web browser. And apparently personas are dramatically better. I believe the term they used was that the enhancements were striking.
Yeah, they did look a lot better.
And it did look a lot better to me. I haven't put the beta on my Vision Pro yet, but I will at some point. I'll take a look. Also, you can do shared movies or games for people in the same space, which is super cool for the one
for all the families that has $3,500 headsets for every member of the family.
Exactly. But that being said, I still think it's very neat. They talked about some enterprise stuff, which for the three of us doesn't really matter. But the short of it is that you can get a common pool of Vision Pro devices, and you can kind of share them amongst team members. I guess what Light Shield, whatever it's called, and all that stuff, notwithstanding, and you know the inserts. Like, I'm not sure how they're going to manage that, but still. I dig it.
Yeah, I think what they said too, like it was very clear that, like, you know, you wonder, like, who is using the Vision Pro, because it doesn't seem like it's that many people. And what we heard Mike Rockwell say, quote, hundreds of companies worldwide use Vision Pro for something. Now that could be that they've sold 200 of them. That could be that they've sold, you know, that they sold them to 201 companies worldwide. But you know, there are, like. And we saw the same thing with Microsoft and HoloLens over the years. Like, there are interesting theoretical uses for specialized industries and stuff like that. We just don't know, like, how many of them are actually doing it. And in the case of HoloLens, the answer was not many. And then they shut it down because not enough people are doing it. But, you know, a lot of these features are very clearly made for, like, okay, a team has, like, one or two Visions Pro to test something on, and they have 10 engineers who occasionally might have to use one or something, you know, so let's make it easier to share them between people. And that's great, because this is still a very, very niche, kind of specialized, extraordinarily expensive device. So, you know, the launched version of the Vision Pro was atrocious at being shared between multiple people. Now, they do still have the hardware problem, as Casey said, about, like, the Light Shield size, the straps, the lenses inside, if you have prescription lens inserts. Like, they do still have all those problems of sharing those needs between people. But at least they have made what appear to be substantial improvements in, like, the realities and convenience of having multiple people share one, or at least trade off or temporarily share one Vision Pro. So, you know, they're finding some kind of market maybe for it. It still seems like it's very optimistic, but they are adding stuff. This is more than I expected to see in this release. Like, I kind of expected there to be almost nothing, like a tvOS level feature improvement to visionOS. And no, it's something. They're still working on it. There is stuff in here like, you know, the VR controller support. And like the 3D model viewing from Safari, there's stuff like that that, like, I don't know why they couldn't have gotten that for the launch, but I'm glad it's here now.
I thought the 3D thing in Safari was there at launch. What am I thinking of, Casey?
I'm not sure. I think the difference is that you can do the 3D stuff within the web page, whereas previously you had to, like, download a USDZ or whatever the heck it is. I might have those details wrong.
Yeah, because that kind of thing, like, that's, you know, that's huge. Like, one of the great things that is possible in the Vision Pro is basically online shopping for things like, you know, how big is this lamp I want to put on my table over there that I'm seeing on some shopping website? You know, oh, will it actually be too big? And you can take measurements, you can try, but, like, before, you know, since basically nothing supports the Vision Pro out there in the content world, you would, you know, see the web page, and, you know, a lot of web pages now will have, like, you know, view in 3D AR on your phone, but those things never work on the Vision Pro. So you have to, like, even if you own a Vision Pro, you have to take it off, take your phone out, and look in the little, you know, 6-inch AR view on your phone. And so hopefully this kind of thing will broaden the compatibility of that kind of thing, and maybe those, like, AR views that are in every web page now, maybe those will just work on Vision Pro now. But if true,
that was
that'd
their
be great.
Strategy with the GoPro and Insta360 thing. It's like, there is existing content out there that in theory should be useful on the Vision Pro, like all those web pages you just talked about that you have to use the phone AR. Can we just change VisionOS so that stuff works? I hope that's what they did with the 3D page stuff and not some new API, because no one's going to do new API for just Vision Pro users. It's not enough of them. But surely for the GoPro and Insta360 and Canon video, these are existing video files made by existing cameras that are just out there that previously, because they weren't the super special Apple format, the Vision Pro just ignored them. But now it's like, we'll take whatever data files you have. You took these videos, they exist in the world. We should be able to show them to you, quote unquote, correctly, like in the 3D way that they're supposed to be shown in Vision Pro. And now they can. That's what they need to be doing with the Vision Pro. Not telling everybody you should shoot all your video in the special format that looks best in Vision Pro, but just saying, what have you got? What have you got out there that we think would look good in a headset? We will learn how to read it. And so it becomes useful.
Yeah, and then going back a half step to enterprise stuff, one of the things they said is that you can save all your settings to an iPhone. And if I understand this right, what this means is, and I think this is applicable outside the enterprise, let's say that John comes to my house and puts on my Vision Pro and sets himself up as a guest user or what have you. I think by some magic, you can, or John can save that information either to my phone or presumably to his phone. And then the next time he puts on my Vision Pro, it can beam that information, you know, slurp that information up from his phone or wherever, such that he doesn't have to do the whole eye calibration and all that. Because if you're not familiar, if Erin uses my Vision Pro, which she does only under protest because she finds it very painful to use, like physically painful to use. But nevertheless, if she puts it on, she does the thing where you know look at the different dots and you pinch your fingers to kind of figure out where your eyes are. And so you can get all that calibrated. If she pulls the Vision Pro off at all and puts it right back on, guess what? She has to do that whole dance over again. And it's a pain in the butt. And so hopefully this will work a lot better such that, you know, I can have her save her profile to somebody's phone and then it'll just load right up the next time.
Imagine that the Vision Pro had the smarts in it of a $10 smart scale that when you step on figures out who you are based on your weight. Imagine if we had that. How about just a giant menu of huge blurry images that you can't see correctly yet because it hasn't converged to just say, Casey, Erin, and you just look to the left for Casey and look to the right for Erin. Yes. Anyway, someday maybe they'll even get a setting syncing across macOS. Can you imagine? We don't have the technology today.
They have the iris ID or iID, whatever.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Just use that. They know who you are.
They did. I think in Vision OS 2, they added like some kind of guest awareness, and we talked about it on the show, but this seems like a step up. And like to Casey's point, like it being portable on your phone is kind of great for an environment where it's like, okay, well, maybe there's like a limit on the actual device, but if you have a bunch of employees in a company and they all have their phones, they just bring their settings with them, you know? So they could go to like some other random headset that they've never worn before, but because the settings are on their phone that they carry with them, it will sync, you know, again, enterprise type sort of Vision OS hoteling. If you know what hoteling means, I'm sorry.
Yep. I sure do. All right. I think we should probably now backtrack to Tahoe because I certainly have plenty to say about iPad. But if you'd rather reverse that, gentlemen, I'm happy to do that.
No,
in reverse
please, let's
order.
Do macOS. Because I think there will be many future shows about macOS, but I'll try to go semi-quickly here. This is the one thing I wanted to get installed, and it was slightly painful. But I did get Tahoe installed, and I have tried it because I needed a lot of questions answered that were not answered in the thing. So they said Tahoe. They're like, oh, it's beautiful. The glassy water, blah. It's like glassy. Yes. Wait, whatever. There's Tahoe for you. And they kind of glossed over a lot of stuff. Like, and of course, it's got the new design. And before they started talking about some features, most of which are cool. But what do they mean that it has the new design? So, number one item. I just got done talking about how they didn't change the icons to be round in iOS or anything else. They're not all round. They're all, it looks like the same squircle type shape. Since, I believe, Big Sur on macOS, they've said, you know, you should make all your Mac icons be squircles. But the squircle was actually like, the standard Apple squircle was like inset within the square area that you're allowed to make an icon. So you have like, you make icons of many different sizes in macOS, but let's just say like 128 by 128. That's your square. And the Big Sur design was make a squircle inside the 128 by 128, but leave space all around it. So your squircle is not 128 by 128. Your squircle is substantially smaller than that because there's a significant white border around the entire thing, but that was the standard. Everyone gets squircle icons. All those squircle icons are smaller than the full area of the thing. And so when I saw that they hadn't changed the icon shape, I'm like, oh, well, that's good for macOS because they've already been on this squircle standard. But of course, not every app adopted squircle-shaped icons. If you just had an old-school icon and yours is 128 by 128, you could fill that whole 128 by 128 with content, or you could make a little thing in the middle, or you could make your icon shape like a frog, or whatever you wanted to do. It was entirely up to you. You could make any shape you want. They recommended squircle. In Tahoe, they insist on squircle. Every iMac icon in Tahoe is in a round rect jail. Doesn't matter what the icon is. Pick any icon you want. For example, Script Editor, the editor app for AppleScript. I don't know if you can visualize that icon because no one probably uses it anymore because AppleScript is somewhat defunct, but not really. But it is a squircle. It's a white squircle with a little AppleScript scroll icon on it. But like many past Apple icons, it has a tool leaning over the squircle. And the tool is a pen. And the pen is floating over the squircle on an angle, and it breaks the bounds of the squircle. The end of the pen goes up past the edge of the squircle. What Tahoe does with that icon, it says, your icon's not a squircle. You go to squircle jail. So it takes the script editor icon, and it shrinks it, and it draws a round rect around the existing round rect, and it makes the background gray. So it's like editor icon on a round rect. They insist that not only is your icon a squircle, but it is only a squircle. You must not break the bounds of the squircle. You go to round rect jail. That's what it will do to your icons. I have icons for two of my three Mac apps that are not squircles. They're going to round rect jail, which is not great. Not great at all. So,
this is even if the app is not recompiled with the new SDK?
Oh, yeah. No, this is the Finder doing this, remember?
Get updated are going to have these gray jails around them?
Well, no. So here's the thing. It's like, okay, but like I said, if your app is following the Big Sur guidelines and it is a quote-unquote a squircle, it's just a bitmap. It's just like for the 128 by 128 size of your icon, it's a 128 by 128 bitmap. It just so happens that there's a transparent background and your squircle is embedded in it or whatever. But I put my non-recompiled straight off the App Store Squircle Hyperspace app and I launched it. And in the dock, it showed just like it does today. It did not put a jail around it. So somehow it knows that my icon is a legit non-boundary broken squircle. And that's all I can tell right now is that it didn't put it in the jail. So I'm not sure what it's using to determine that, but I know that my Mac App Store version of my app knows nothing about Tahoe. But on Tahoe, it was not in jail. So this is going to be a problem area. And your icons that are put in this jail, they look terrible. Apple's icons look terrible. Your icons will look terrible. It's not, you don't want it. I don't actually know the answer to this question. We'll find out in future episodes, but like, if I want to get out of this jail, what can I do? Do I have to make my icon a squircle, or can I preemptively squircle myself? Can I put myself in my own background and say, because then you at least get to pick your margins and like how you're centered in the squircle, and then will you just allow me to display myself that way? Setting aside the third thing, which is, I still don't know the answer to this. On macOS, can I use Icon Composer to make an icon out of a series of layers that it will put the translucent glass treatment on, blah, blah, blah? Can I do that or can I not do that? And if I do that, can I say on all previous OSs, use the my existing icon, but when you're on the new OS, use this new one? The icon, perhaps surprisingly, the icon situation is the most fraught on macOS. It's really annoying and absurd and one of many things in Tahoe that turns out to be way uglier than you think it's going to be, at least in this first beta.
All right, so we got icons covered. Then the menu bar is now completely transparent, and I expected to absolutely grab and clutch my pearls when I saw this. I actually don't think it's bad. I think it's fine.
So we've been here before and past OSs where they tried to make it super-duper transparent, but something happens when you make it not there. Like, there is no background. It is there's no border. There's no nothing. It's just like the word, file, edit. Those are just sitting there. There's no line underneath them. There's no background behind them. It is gone. And what that is essentially is the naked robotic menu bar. Because they're saying, what's the minimum we can ship? Because if you don't like this, you could just do a desktop background that has a white stripe on the top of it. Now, it's annoying if you change resolution a lot because that white stripe won't be the right thickness all the time. But if you don't change resolution a lot, you could put a desktop background on that gives you a menu bar that is 100% white, which is a thing that was much more difficult to do back when they were like, oh, well, the menu bar will incorporate colors from your whole desktop background and pull them up into it and smear them across. Like, you could try to influence that by putting a white thing behind it, but it would pull colors from elsewhere on your background and still kind of make it weird. But with this, with 100% clear, make the menu bar however you want. And by the way, if you really can't stand this, if you turn on reduced transparency in macOS Tahoe, at least in the first beta, it will just give you a white menu bar again. So I'm not a super big fan of this. I think it's kind of dumb because, well, it's not as dumb as the floating toolbar. That is the winner of the worst decision that they made in this redesign. But it does mean that the menu bar text now has to display legibly over whatever your background is. Because remember, it's not doing anything to what's behind the text. So you can, it's real easy, and I would have done this if I was doing a review, to come up with a background that makes your menu bar 100% illegible. It's real easy. Just put something in there with a bunch of words, for example, like, or put zebra stripes or put dots, or like, it's, and I don't know if, like, I haven't actually tried it, so maybe they detect that and try to do something about it, but like, to what end? What is the benefit that I get from this? Why do I need to see my desktop background behind the word file for the file menu? And by the way, when you mouse over it, a lozenge appears and like smears it. And so you actually, like, when you're mousing over it, it becomes more legible. I guess it lets you see more of your desktop picture if you really want to see that top sliver. Of course, they could also accomplish that by having a normal menu bar and having the desktop picture start at the bottom of the menu bar. But then, of course, they have auto-hiding menu bar, so they need to move the image up. Like, this just seems like a change because they felt like doing it. You've got the notch up there, too, taking some of the real estate. But I don't know. It doesn't bother me that much. Like, honestly, completely gone and is, in my opinion, better than all of the almost completely gone things that they've done before. I'd prefer it if it was just white or black, because I don't think it is valuable to see my desktop image behind the words in the menu bar. But because it is 100% clear, I have the option to not do that if I really care that much.
All right. There's allegedly more menu bar and control center layout customizations. They did a lot with changing the color of folders in Finder. And additionally,
that's a
you can add symbols.
Yeah, so the colors is a throwback. When they introduced labels in macOS, or I believe it was System 6 for the Mac 2, I believe that the original implementation of labels, well, I'm not entirely sure. I'm old and don't remember. I think they might have just changed the color behind the text. But anyway, at some point in classic macOS, when you applied a label to a folder, it would color tint the folder icon itself. And at some point in macOS 10 history, they said, oh, we'll put that little circle next to it, you know, in the Finder, like in List View, or like, it doesn't like tint the whole icon. And coloring the icon is better. It makes the folder stand out more. It's easy to pick out. It looks nicer. So I heavily endorse this change because I think labels are a great feature. And I think their being minimized in recent years has really hurt them. I like adding the symbols to folders because this is a thing that there's apps that do this for you that will make a folder for you with an icon on it. But like, because Apple changes the folder icon, like in every OS in subtle ways, you'd end up with this hodgepodge of icons. If they're made by like past versions of some app, they all don't match each other. Now I hope what it's doing, it's all just like programmatic and structured, saying, here's the symbol, here's the label, and then whatever OS you're using, we'll pick the color, we'll composite them together. I think this is one of the better changes in macOS. I look forward to having colored folders with cool icons on them.
Cool.
Oh, and by the way, on the menu bar and control center customization, it's very much like when you try to customize control center on iOS or iPadOS, where you get that like the little widgets and the dragging out the things. Only they've extended that. They've significantly changed this portion of system settings. So if you think system settings haven't changed at all, it has. This one lets you like find things, like what the search feature is enhanced to find the widget you want and then drag it from there to the menu bar, or at least hit a plus button in the menu bar and select from a thing of widgets. It's very janky and broken in the first beta, but you can see that they're doing something very different here, and I think it will probably be better than the existing system of just scrolling through that giant list and trying to find places where things are. But it's hard to say in its current janky state, but it seemed to me that the search worked better, and this is all new UI for dealing with the stuff in the menu bar. I couldn't figure out how it worked at first glance, which is not a great endorsement of its like usability and obviousness, but I'll give them some benefit of the doubt that they'll get this straightened out before it's released.
There's now more continuity with other devices. You get live activities on macOS in the menu bar, which I am here for. If they can make that work and it doesn't look dumb, I dig it. Additionally, there's now phone app in macOS, so you can place calls and whatnot. They also spent a surprising amount of time talking shortcuts, including that you can run shortcuts automatically based on time of day, saving a file to a folder, connecting a display. This reminds me of, what was it, Control Plane or something like that from many years ago, which may even still be a thing for all I know, which was, I think, the tagline, and we've talked about this on the show before, is context-aware computing, which basically, based on what Wi-Fi you're connected to and what displays you have connected, it would let you run different things. This was many many, many, many years ago now, but it was a great app. There are intelligent actions where you can have it do things using their language model. Additionally, Spotlight has gotten a serious overhaul. You can do all sorts of different things. You can browse your content, including most relevant files, and that also includes intelligent suggestions, recent apps, system actions, including Play Podcast. You can send an email with parameters, and they did a demo of how this works in app with our friend, Gus Mueller's Acorn, which was super cool to see. So congratulations to Gus. Then they also have a clipboard history, which I never thought I'd see the day, but that's pretty cool too.
Yeah, so I think they undersold that because it's like, oh, and by the way, we have clipboard history built in. The way it's implemented is weird. Like it's in Spotlight, which may not be where you expect it. If you figure out all the shortcuts, it's like Command Space, Command 4, Down Arrow, Return. Like, it's not that different than most of the clipboard managers you have. I do like that it's built in, but it's pretty hidden. Like, I do wonder if people are going to discover. I kind of wish that a clipboard manager was built in. I don't know. I guess you have to make it part of Spotlight because where else would it be? But yeah, so this is the biggest upgrade Spotlight has gotten in years. It hasn't suddenly become Raycast or even Quicksilver, but it has gotten way more features than it used to have. Like in that world of things like, you know, Alfred, Quicksilver, Raycast, what's the other one? There's a bunch of
Launch Bar.
Yeah. Some of those things just have a tremendous number of features that are incredibly extensible. Again, those are third-party apps. Those are for more like the pro users. Spotlight is what most people use. It's an okay app launcher. Now it's also an okay clipboard manager, an okay action thingy. Like, it's like, even just using it for 2 seconds, I'm like, oh, this is better. Like, they've made it better because, like, there's obvious prior art that they should copy from, and they did. And they made simplified versions of that stuff without as many features and tweaks or whatever, but I'm so glad this year. It's so good that I'm actually debating whether I'm going to stop using Quicksilver and start using that instead for most of my things. I think I'll still stick to PasteBot because I'm a little bit more sophisticated user of clipboard history. But having just gone through the years-long effort to get almost everyone else in my family to use clipboard managers almost all the time because they're so useful, it'll be so great that I'll be like, look, you don't even worry about if you have PasteBot on your new Mac. It's just built in.
Yeah, and you know, keep in mind that's also, you know, having this all this functionality built into the Spotlight UI on the Mac. Some of it appears to be available on iPadOS as well. I don't know if we know any details about how much of it yet. But that's like step one to getting it on the iPad as well. And then you have clipboard history on the iPad, which was never possible
in
a
good way.
It should
be on the phone too, is it? Do you know?
Maybe.
You have it on you have the phone OS called. Do you pull down Spotlight? Is there anything that looks like clipboard history in there?
I'm looking at an iPad. No. I don't see squat, but I probably am not understanding how to activate it. So
Command 4. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, I mean, this might be a Casey issue, and maybe it's there, and I just don't realize it.
No, it looks, the UI on the iPhone looks exactly like it did before. Just now everything's slower and glossy.
Yeah, I mean, so this is the thing. We've talked about this before. Clipboard history should be across all their platforms. It should be a baseline feature across all their platforms, and I'm glad they added it to some places. But it's kind of weird in the year where they're unifying everything that it's not everywhere.
But hey, but that's step one. Step one is get it on any of their platforms. And then slowly maybe they'll add it to the other ones.
All right. And then we continue on. There's a games app. There's some stuff about Metal 4, which I could not possibly care less about. So, John,
On the Metal 4 thing, two things on that. One, I've briefly seen people go by saying that this is a change on the level of DirectX 10 or OpenGL 3 and that it actually is a breaking change from the previous versions of Metal, presumably for good reasons. Not a big deal unless you're a game developer or someone working on a game engine, but there's that. And the frame interpolation, we talked about that when we were talking about DLSS, I think in the context of the Switch or whatever. For years and years, gaming cards have all had their own alphabet soup technology that would first upscale your image intelligently to make it look better and then eventually upscale it and also add frames that didn't exist, like synthesized frames, and we talked about that on past shows. Metal is a little bit behind here in that they already have some kind of smart upscaling, and I think this is their first frame interpolation thing where it will generate frames for you. Surely it is not state-of-the-art, surely it is not best-in-class, but it is a thing that Apple needs to have. So every time I look at anything having to do with Metal, I'm like, Apple's pretty good at this. It's a shame they don't know how to do anything else with games, but like, Metal is actually good. If somehow they could convince the entire industry to make games based on metal. It's got pretty good performance, and the only thing holding it back is that it doesn't have the world's best game developers pushing and pushing it like all the other, you know, DirectX and Sony's APIs and everything, and all those, the video card drivers for Windows. Like, there's that whole ecosystem that is driving the rest of the industry forward, and Apple's here all by itself plugging away, and all by themselves they're doing a pretty good job making a really good API that almost nobody uses and almost nobody cares about, that's always a little bit behind everybody else.
All right, and then this is when VisionOS actually happened, which we already spoke about. And then we get to iPadOS, and the rumor was that this was the year. We did it, Joe. I think that's the second time I've made this joke in as many weeks. But nevertheless, we finally got functional iPad multitasking, or so they claim. I was very skeptical. I was giving my side eye. I was so skeptical. Or my side eye was giving side eye. I was so skeptical. But I got to tell you, I think we might have done it. I think this might be it. And I immediately put iPadOS 26 on my iPad because I'm a fool and I don't listen to my own advice. But also because the iPad, like I said earlier, is not a critical device for me. This is great. Like, there are a lot of problems with this beta in a general sense, like especially animations and like the whole liquid glass stuff is not great, or whatever they're calling the design system. A lot of that is not squared away yet, but multitasking is excellent. I am loving the little bit of time I've spent with it. I don't know why it took 10 years or whatever it's been, 15 years to finally just say to us, you know what, maybe we should mimic the Mac. And I'm stealing some of your thunder here, John.
Well, but you know, what they really did was the Bono thing that we just talked about. This is like stories of surrender. Finally, they just said, give up and make Windows that you can resize and move around. Guess what, Casey? You are the janitor.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Steve Jobs derisively said, oh, you got to manage your own Windows, making you the janitor. Sometimes you just want to move and resize the stuff on your screen in a series of windows. And they tried for so long to come up with something better. And I think they did come up with a whole bunch of better things with limited functionality. But the moment you want to do something that doesn't fit within one of those paradigms, you're into this weird world of like playing this game of figuring out, okay, within these constraints and within the things that it's possible to do, now I have to bargain. Okay, I can have two apps side by side. I can have one slide over, and I can have this image here. Like, it's like just at a certain point, it's like give up and use Windows. Stories of surrender. Like let us have Windows with window widgets. And it's so funny to me how they, you know, we talked about this last time, of like that they did not want to have any kind of sort of always visible window control because that's against the iPad paradigm. And people are like, well, but they've got those three dots in the top center of the thing. I'm like, oh, but that's like the three dot menu. You know, and that is sort of like overlaying your content, but it's so tiny and it's not the same as having like always visible things and the ability to arbitrarily resize and move. And you know what Apple did with this thing? They're like, okay, we're going to take the three dots. We're going to move them to the upper left corner, which already is a big change, because having them dead center in the top is like, it's saying, oh, this is just a little thing at the top of your window. Just ignore it. It's overlaying your content. It's not a big deal. Moving it to the top left, it's like, okay, now there's a dedicated spot for this. And make the three dots a little bit bigger. And put them in a capsule, which is a trend, by the way, that I do like with this new design system, that basically everything in the title bar area has a capsule outlined around it.
Everything everywhere has a capsule.
Yeah. It's not a high contrast capsule, but they're not just like iOS 7, just like line art floating in space, and good luck to you figuring out what's a button and what's not. But anyway, they put the three dots in the upper left-hand corner. And now when you go over the three dots, you know what they turn into? Freaking macOS stoplight widgets. It's like, yes, there you go. You did it. There's essentially a title bar. I mean, at the same time, macOS has slowly been losing its title bars. Now iPadOS has half a title bar. You can drag windows around. You can close, minimize, and expand them with the stoplight widgets. You can resize them from the edges. You can put them wherever the hell you want. The very first demo the person did who was demoing this is, she took a window, she dragged it halfway off the screen. She's like, you know what? There's a thing you can do with windows. you dragged a window so it's halfway, but you can't see half the window. It's like, sometimes that's what you want to do. Maybe for 2 seconds, maybe you just care about things in the left edge. I do it all the time on macOS. It's a thing you can do when you have control over the windows. You can literally put them anywhere you want, make them any size you want. Hallelujah. Now, I don't know how good this is going to be, because people are saying like, oh, you just made a worse Mac. Like, why not just use a Mac at that point? Like, but they didn't. Like, because from my understanding, all the other modes are still there. They demoed one of them. They're like, look, you just want everything to be a full screen. Everything's full screen. You don't have to deal with any of this stuff. And you can still do splits. And I think Stage Manager is also still there. So if you like that, you can do that. But also, there's this mode, which is take a bunch of windows, put them wherever the hell you want. Now, maybe there's still limits. Casey, can you tell me? If you like 10 windows, does it start yelling at you? What's the limit?
I haven't gotten that. I mean, I can futz around while we're talking here.
How does it behave with 100 windows?
All it said, the phrase used in the presentation was, even more windows. It doesn't say how many. I'm sure it varies by model and by how much RAM it has, too. Because, like, you know, keep in mind, like, one of the things that has kept iPadOS until recently from having more advanced multitasking is, like, you know, as we've discussed long ago, iOS has no swap file for the virtual memory system. And so...
But iPadOS does now.
Right. Well, it does, but I think it's only for like certain apps like Photoshop to try to use. I don't think they actually try to use it for apps.
I don't remember where that was lying. But anyway, the technology is there. I would be surprised if they just don't start using it for the whole. If it's look at this. Like, I believe the iPad Pro now has more RAM, has more than 8 gigs, right? Doesn't it?
Well, but they have certain models where it's like if you get the 1 terabyte, you know, iPad, then you have more RAM.
Then you get like 16 or whatever.
Yeah, but whatever it is. So like there is enough resources now to run a bunch of iPads. I mean, the funny thing is that, like, you know, you were saying how like the hallelujah, you can move a window partly off screen. Like for me, my like, oh my God moment was when they showed live window resizing of an iPad app. And it's like, it's so funny, like, we're celebrating these things
things that happened in macOS in 2001.
Or like, you know, 30, yeah, like these like 30-year-old things in computing that, you know, that happen on desktop and laptops. Like, we're celebrating them on the iPad finally coming in 2025.
Because it evolved from a fixed resolution device that became a one or two different fixed resolution devices that became a single fixed resolution iPad that became one or two different resolution iPads that became, well, size classes that, and it's just like creeping up slowly on, look, just let people resize windows. And like on macOS, you can't arbitrarily resize windows. Some windows can't get any smaller than a certain size because it will look bad. So the developer said, no, you can't make this window any smaller because then it won't work layout wise. Like, you have control over it and you have control over how the space is used when you resize it. But it's kind of been like growing pains of the historical baggage of iPadOS is that it didn't start as a thing where people could take your window and make it any size they want within your constraints. It was the other way, which is like there's only one there's one iPad and it comes in one resolution and that's what you designed for. And they're kind of paying for that now with all the apps that are going to have to that are probably going to be pretty janky, arbitrarily resized until or unless the developers update them.
Well, because that's the other thing. Like, because iPadOS didn't start out having resizable windows, most of the multitasking, you know, versions so far, if you had like an older app that wasn't updated for whatever the current system was, it just wouldn't be resizable or it wouldn't be split screenable or whatever. So, you know, we don't know yet like how many of those are still left. Is it going to try to wedge those into the system or not? You know, what's going to happen if an app was designed for full screen on an iPad that doesn't have that big of a screen, like an iPad mini, and, you know, you try to resize it there because they said this works on the mini. So, like, how is that going to be handled? One of the challenges that iPadOS has always had is that as they implement these different multitasking things, iPad apps just aren't updated that often by a lot of companies, or not supported at all, or barely supported, or they ship one once and then, you know, Google Docs style, they take like forever, you know, to update to the latest stuff, like, you know, 2 years later or whatever. And again, I mean, that's again partly because of Apple declaring war on everybody ever. But also just, you know, the economics of maintaining a really good iPad app are difficult for most companies to justify. So of all this stuff, like, I hope it works. I hope people support it enough to make this stuff work. That being said, I'm glad that they are going in the direction of just make multitasking work like it does in the Mac. Because there seems to be this almost like this condescending view of what users can and can't understand about computing. And they've tried over years, you know, the iPad has been a huge success in usability for computing novices. That, you know, you have this simple device, you can't fill it up with malware, it's easy, you just go into an app, when you're done, you hit the home button or whatever now, and you go back and, you know, nice and easy. And then they've always tried to keep that simplicity over there, while then adding special hidden gestures or things to enter multitasking modes. And they've tried to make those multitasking modes really simple over time, but they haven't really succeeded. They've been very difficult to use, actually. They've been both, you know, hard for novices to figure out how they look and work and how to, you know, close windows and stuff. And they've been limiting to power users who always want a more Mac-like windowing experience. Now they're saying, you know what? For the users who want it to be simple and full screen, that's still going to work that way. Great. That's how it always – that was always an option. And then for people who want to have multiple things on screen, we're just going to make it work like Macs and PCs have worked for decades. Because you know what? It turns out no one needs anything in the middle. You don't need – like the people who are novices who don't know how to use multitasking windowing systems, they'll use it the regular way, the full screen way. And for everyone else – just give them the version of this that exists everywhere else in the computing world. So I'm glad they finally got rid of that terrible middle that just sucked for all sides of this equation.
I think some people still do like the middle. I think the middle should still exist, but the problem, I think the reason the middle got so much slack is because, so much flack rather, is because there was nothing above it. And now that there is something above it, I think it's like, well, if people like Stage Manager, if people like Split View, let them use it, because above that is the thing that gives you much more flexibility. So I think the middle is perfectly fine now that there's something above it.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing to consider too is like, how different of an experience is it when you're using it with a trackpad versus when you're using it by touch?
Yeah, they have the new cursor that looks like an arrow, not a Mac mm-hmm. arrow because it doesn't have a stem, but it's an arrow for more precise control. Like it's basically recognizing, look, you have an M4 iPad Pro and you have an M4 MacBook Air. And you can't get them with the same amount of RAM unless you get them maybe the 1 terabyte one. But like, they're basically the same hardware. And the MacBook Air is so much more capable. You could have so many things on the screen, do so many things at once. It's a Mac, right? But hardware-wise, why shouldn't the iPad be able to do a bunch of that stuff? So now a bunch of the limitations have been removed. I mean, we can get to the next one, which is background tasks. Oh, you're exporting Final Cut Pro?
Hold on. So first of all, you asked me how many apps can I get open. Now, I have an 11-inch iPad Pro from 2022, I think. It was before they got super-duper thin. And I got like 7 apps open at once, but given that it's an 11-inch screen, it's useless at that many. Like, not because of speed, but because I just don't have the real estate to really support that many apps.
Now people can make like apps that are useful as like a widget size experience. You know what I mean? Like an app mm-hmm. that is just like a mini player for music, for example.
Right. I mean, and the other thing that was interesting was during installation or upgrade or whatever, it asked me in so many words, I didn't have the presence of mind to take a screenshot, but it's also in settings. If you go into settings and the multitasking and gestures, it asked me roughly the same thing during setup. And what it says now in settings is at the very top of the screen, you have 3 different options, each of which has a thumbnail, and whichever one you choose then animates. Your choices are full screen apps. Always use full screen app. Let me try that again. Always use apps full screen and swipe home to switch between them. The middle option is windowed apps, which is what I have selected. Resize and arrange multiple windows in a single space to multitask with ease. Learn more, which is a link. And then finally, Stage Manager. Arrange windows across multiple groups for a focused multitasking experience. Learn more. And so you do have all 3 modes for sure. I suspect that Stage Manager is just like a limitation or an alternate version of the windowed apps thing.
Do you still slide over?
Let me see. No, not now, as far as I can tell.
I'm going to miss that because I use that a lot. That's one of the middle modes that I use, which is full screen video, but with a slide over thing mm-hmm. that I pull out from the side. That is extremely useful to me, and I'll be sad if I can't still do that. But you probably can. It's probably just buried in there somewhere.
Maybe. I'm not sure. And then, shoot, there was something else I was going to tell you, but I don't know what it was. That's all right. So this, again, just very briefly, super digging it. Super duper digging it. And it still doesn't, I mean, there's still plenty of things that I can't do on my iPad that I can do on my Mac, but this makes doing a lot of things much, much easier, because so often I wanted to have either 2 windows, or which I could do, you know, with like a split screen or whatever, but oftentimes 3 windows, which was effectively impossible. You could do like a slide over dance on top of split screen, which was not fun. And granted, it's been an hour that I've actually had to play with this, but so far I am super into it, and I am overjoyed that they finally just threw their hands up and said, you know what? If you want to have window management, then have friggin' window management and shut up about it. And I am so excited. So that being said, I think I interrupted you earlier. You were starting to try to talk about long-running stuff. So do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, that was the limitation of people who complain about, that you get this pro-level app, and when you're exporting your Final Cut project, you have to leave Final Cut in the foreground or the export will end. So they added background tasks that aren't immediately killed and aren't super limited, and they incorporated it into the live activities. It's still kind of limited because, like, look, every app on the Mac, if you make it do a thing and then leave that app to go to another app and make that app do a thing and then leave that app to go, all those apps just keep doing their stuff. There are various process controls and determinations from the developer and the OS about what cores they run on and so on and so forth. But the Mac way is not that, oh, when I clicked away from an app, the thing that it's doing, like, stops or isn't allowed to run. That's not the Mac way. But the iPad way was like, oh, if you want to do anything in the background, because of the history, it came from a phone type device and a phone type OS with extremely limited resources. But here we are today with incredibly powerful iPad Pros, and it's ridiculous that they couldn't do an export of Final Cut Pro in the background or something. So now they can. But they expose it through live activities as essentially, it's kind of like the download list in Safari. Here are the things that are running in the background. Because previously there's been zero of those. And now apps can put them there. Not sure that's a scalable solution. Like, there's no place in macOS where you get like a pull down menu of all the things all the apps are doing. It's like, those are the apps. They're all doing stuff. Like, any app can do anything. It's a Mac app. And an iPad OS, it's like, if an app wants to do a thing and not be killed when it's not in the foreground, it needs to do this special thing, and we'll put you in this special list. It's a step in the right direction, put it that way. Like, I still think it's kind of like a baby step. I still think it's weird and awkward to coalesce it's almost like a miniature version of Activity Monitor that they only expect there to be four things. But, like, have you ever looked at Activity Monitor on your Mac and see how many things are running? And there's that many things running on your iPad too. They just don't show them to you. But from your apps, like, they can elevate something important they're doing. They're doing an export and, you know, and Final Cut Pro. This app is now rendering this thing, and that will appear in live activity. So I think it's a good start. I worry a little bit that the interface is not scalable if that list gets very large. But it's one more limitation knocked down. And by the way, like, we fault iPadOS for taking so long to do the obvious dumb thing. I give them some grace to have tried to find a better way. They just did not succeed, and so it took a long time. They took a long time to recognize we don't have any better ideas than Windows and, you know, moving them around and window widgets or whatever. I mean, they can have a better idea about how to implement those windows, and we'll see if they did that. But they took a long time to finally surrender, and they have. And we'll see how it works. I haven't actually tried it. I think there may be some awkwardness to the way they've implemented the things, but their heart is in the right place. I think this will satisfy a lot of people who are frustrated by the limitations of iPadOS. Not all of them, because there's still tons of stuff that a Mac can do better, and it is a little bit weird that you can buy an iPad for more than a Mac and it is less capable, but, you know, one WWDC at a time.
Indeed. But nevertheless, I am super excited about all this. The Files app got updated. I never use the Files app, probably because it's a pile of crap.
Of a pile of crap now.
It's more Finder-like. Colored folders. You got like a list view with disclosure triangles. And I snarkily tweeted that turns out the Mac has some good ideas when it comes to multitasking. And then they showed the Files app, and I was like, turns out the Mac has some good ideas about file management too. List view with folders with disclosure triangles and labels. Imagine! It's still a little bit Fisher-Pricey with the big icons and the preview things or whatever, but the Files app getting some love is endorsed. And open with, and so, like, just basic functionality we take for granted on the Mac finally coming in dribs and drabs to the iPad, I think is just a thumbs up. This is the cleanest win of all of the sections of the keynote, in my opinion, is the iPad section.
Yeah, I mean, all the iPad stuff was a complete win. And then additionally, apparently this was the get podcasters like us to stop whining portion of the show, because they also said, hey, you know, occasionally people want to record, content creators want to do stuff on the iPad. So you know what we should do? We should allow for you to have local capture of microphones and video, and then be able to share that using our fancy new Files app. So hypothetically, I could, and maybe I'll do this one day just to mess with Marco, I could take my setup and connect it to my iPad, and we could record ATP, or I could record ATP on my iPad. Imagine that. It would be incredible, except maybe for Marco, especially if it failed.
But please, for the love of God, don't do this.
We will see. But anyways, it is a theoretical possibility, and I am really, really excited about that because, again, as we've all said so many times, these are such incredibly powerful devices that have been neutered by software for so long, and now there are still problems here and there, but in so many ways, this seems like it is so, so much better now, and I am really, really excited for it. Again, in my very brief experience, it's been excellent so far. Granted, it's first beta, so everything is slightly broken, but that's, you know, that's the way first betas always are. I am so incredibly excited for all of this. iPad, two extraordinarily enthusiastic thumbs up.
Oh, rewinding slightly, I forgot to mention this in the macOS section, although I think it applies to more than just macOS. Another thing that is baffling to me about this, the new redesign across all their OSs is their decision on how to handle sidebars. I think it's on iPadOS as well. For the past, I don't know, probably the past decade, if you've looked at any of the Apple platforms, they have been in their drive to add more, to leave more room for your content, they've been shoving everything out to the side. So like the title bar on the Mac used to be a place that was controlled by the OS and apps didn't draw anything there. And suddenly they're like, well, but what if that's not true? What if the three window widgets draw, but there actually is no title bar, and actually the app can draw stuff up there all the way to the edge of the window? And same thing with sidebars. So like, well, why don't we just let the sidebar, like everything runs full bleed to the edge, and there's a thin dividing line between the sidebar and the content, and if the window has rounded corners, guess what? Your sidebar also has rounded corners because your sidebar runs full bleed edge to edge. In this new design, they've decided what the sidebar is a rounded rectangle that is inset with a margin around it, with a border around it, and that rounded rectangle sidebar is floating on top of and within the larger window. And the window widgets themselves are like part of the floating sidebar thing. Like what I'm saying is there's a border there. Like they left space between the inner rounded rectangle and the outer rounded rectangle. And I'm like, what's that space good for? It looks visually awkward. Nothing can draw there. Like your content doesn't appear there. Not that it would be useful even if it did, but it doesn't. And it adds this little extra ring around all sidebars of slightly different texture, slightly different color background, because again, the contrast between them is very low, but it's there, it's visible. I'm not sure I dig this look on any of the OSs, but especially not on macOS, because I feel like you're taking away pixels from content for no reason. Kind of like the floating toolbar, but like literally there's nothing there. Maybe if you had like a full bleed image in like preview and you had the sidebar work. Anyway, you'll all see it in Xcode, because Xcode's got a sidebar, and guess what? It's a floating round rectangle that floats on top of the window that incorporates the window widgets, and it looks real weird. So you should fire up Xcode when you get this and see how you feel about it. And then the second thing is, the new design on macOS in particular, you know, rounded corners and everything, heavily rounded corners that in various places is not harmonious with the placement of the window widgets, because they got to work on that. But here's the thing. Not all Macs have rounded corner screens. In fact, most Macs, well, most desktop Macs do not have rounded corner
screens.
Who
uses those?
Many. On an M4 MacBook Air, I think not all the corners are round. I have it next to me, but it's not open right now. Like, some screens have square corners. The Pro Display XDR has square corners. But the rounding of the corners in Tahoe is so rounded that it makes me wonder, like, if there's a Pro Display XDR successor, is it going to have, like, 1-inch radius rounded corners, like, in the hardware? Classic macOS and the original Mac, they would just black out the pixels that are there in the corner, and maybe they'll do that in future OSs. But it is weird on macOS to see such heavily rounded corners, and it is unharmonious with the sharp squared edges that are on some edges of Mac screens, especially a third-party screen, of course, but some first-party screens are still like that as well. So I'm not entire. I mean, I know why they did it. It's trying to, everything is rounded, everything has to be harmonious, but it makes me fear that they're going to take away those corner pixels, because it's a lot of them. It's not like Mac Windows already rounded, right? And the Mac menu bar used to be rounded with blacking out the pixels and stuff, but this is a much bigger radius than it was, and I have some concern about that.
Then we briefly got a little bit of talk about developers, Foundation Models Framework, like we had said. You can get from it plain text or structured Swift data, which we saw a little bit about in State of the Union, which we're not going to get to today. Appetence with visual intelligence. We've got Swift and Swift UI that's allegedly getting better. The aforementioned Icon Composer app, Xcode, they talked about how it's got built-in support for ChatGPT and other models of our choosing, which sounds really great. The developer betas did come out earlier today. Then we had the ending song, which, again, I really wanted to hate, but I actually thought was kind of amusing.
So this is actually, the ending song, I think, is a good example of how they can walk the line. They're not actually doing anything to improve their relationship with developers in this WWDC, to be clear, right? They're not actually changing any policies. They're certainly not having a dialogue, reaching out. They're not doing any of those things. So let's be clear about that. But is there something they can do to be nice to developers that is not, I'm not going to say not substantive, but like is not one of like, not, no, they're not actually solving the problem. And the choice to do this song at the end was a good example because here's what it was about. Like the lyrics in the song were singing positive reviews as written on the App Store. They just pulled positive reviews from the App Store about apps and put them to music and put them in a song. I presume these are real App Store reviews. The apps themselves are real. So I recognized a whole bunch of them. Okay. Here's why this was a good choice at the very least. It was positive things about apps. They were third-party apps. So Apple is essentially has someone singing the praises of third-party apps, and it does not center Apple in any way. It wasn't singing about how great Apple is for having an app store, how great Apple is for giving you this opportunity. It was 100% customer, third-party developer, love fest. These customers love these apps, and Apple is nowhere to be seen. That sentiment is an example of them doing something that could that is potentially beneficial to the relationship between Apple's developers. Not something important or big, like, you know, actually speaking with their mouth words and reaching out and saying we understand you and changing policies. None of that. But if they had made this the opening instead of the F1 ad, I think it would have put me in a better mood for the whole rest of the thing. So I give the ending song a big thumbs up, not because it was just an amazing song or amazingly fun or whatever, but because it showed happy customers and happy developers and did not center Apple.
Yep. I mean, I enjoyed it, even though I didn't want to, but I did.
Yeah, I'm with you, Casey. I thought, I'm like, oh no, this is going to be stupid. But you know what? It was fine. It was fun. I enjoyed it.
Yep. Yeah, and imagine if one of your apps was one of those apps that got shown. You know, it's like, it's
my reviews it's a nice are not that kind.
Well, you know, I think they pick ones that didn't have a lot of words because that had to fit into the lyrics, but you know. Anyway, it was nice. Oh, and it's slightly rewinding a bit for the Xcode stuff. I know we're not talking about State of the Union now, but like, it's worth mentioning that basically the Swift Assist feature that didn't ship last year now has come back with a vengeance and is even better if the demos are to be believed. So didn't want to leave you hanging on that, but that's a thing. And they saved it towards the end. And I know that's mostly State of the Union stuff. We'll talk about it next week, but I give a thumbs up to them not giving up on Swift Assist, but instead sort of essentially regrouping and coming up with something even better that I presume will ship for real. I installed Xcode and have launched it, and maybe I just didn't activate that part or don't know how it works. Or actually, I think I tried it and it had some kind of error. So I guess the jury's still out over whether it works because we're only hours in here and I haven't actually tried it. But if their demos are to be believed, Swift Assist lives, and it seems like even better than what they announced last year.
Yeah, I'm really excited to play with it, but it appears, as far as I can tell, to only be on Tahoe, which I don't plan to install anywhere for any reason anytime soon. So I probably won't be able to play with it for a while, unfortunately. But in principle, it looked great. So yeah, overall,
the phrase they used was, quote, "We've expanded our vision for Swift Assist," which is okay, great. I mean, it's so
they
far
did.
That yeah they did like they didn't
deliver
the first vision.
It does more
vision.
Stuff than it used to, and you know, just like the other ones, a little help from my friends. The Apple gets by with a little help from its friends because you know their models can't do code stuff. Hey, ChatGPT, can you help out here? Anthropic, can we want to use? You have good coding models. I think that's a smart move. I think like stop. Yeah. That's an example of either desperation or humility to say we do not have the best coding model. Let's when we're going to add this feature to Xcode. Let's just have a pop-up menu and say, use Claude, use Sonnet, use ChatGPT, or use Apples, and then let people pick which one they want.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if maybe this is, I mean, I kind of expected the timeline to be longer on this, but I wonder, you know, we heard, 6 months ago or whatever, that, like, Craig Federighi was making everybody open to the idea of using other people's third-party models when they can make the best product with those. This seems like doing exactly that. And I think, you know, given Apple's position in AI right now, which is pretty weak still, and not super competitive with any of the, you know, frontier models for almost anything, that's the right move. Like, for things like that, you know, obviously, like, for on-device local processing, Apple's great at that. They probably will remain class-leading for the foreseeable future at that, because that is, like, that does everything Apple's really good at. They're really good at power efficiency. They're really good at like, single computing device excellence. Like, how can we make the best computer, the best phone, the best tablet? Like, they're really good at that. They're not so good at, like, these giant big data problems where you need, like, cutting-edge AI researchers doing, you know, making the most smart things on these huge servers. Like, that's much less their style, you know, and things like that have been less their style forever. So I can see Apple always being really good at local models. And so in the time that may be forever, but in the current time where they're not good at the really big frontier size models that run on big servers, partnering with other companies and creating a platform for the other companies to run their stuff in a way that helps Apple's apps and Apple's customers' apps, that's the right move. This could be the way they do things forever. Maybe they will never lead in big AI models. That might be okay if they do a good enough job being the platform. We'll see how it goes over time. But for now, this was the right move, and I'm glad they finally are really doing what appears to be a pretty big job of finally embracing that strategy.
I feel like Google and OpenAI are also ahead in small models that run on device, because their just models are better at everything, including their little models. Google especially is always touting how small they can get their model. I mean, that's been Apple's whole thing, too, about Apple Intelligence. It's been a struggle for them to get their models down to the point where they can fit on their phones, which is part of why they expanded the RAM. And even with the expanded RAM, it's been a struggle to get the models down to that level. But yeah, Google and OpenAI have been also working on that for their small models, especially Google for the little models they can run on device. So Apple is not even in the lead on small models, but they have great hardware, and if they can expose that great hardware to other people's models, I think in the Swift Assist thing, I think these are all server models. I think they're going out to the server for Claude and ChatGPT. They don't have like the local. I don't know. I haven't looked at it that much, but I don't know if those companies have optimized their models to run on the phone or whatever, or on locally on a Mac. We'll see. But the fact that you have that option at all is like, now it just comes down to like how good is the interface, and jury's still out on that. I tried to use it, and like I said, it failed. And the demos I've seen in State of the Union that we'll talk about, I'm not entirely sure they've nailed the interface, but I don't think anybody has at this point with these kind of like help me code along type of things. What I can say is they put in a lot of work. They've added a lot of UI for this, and it's fairly sophisticated UI. So the extra year working on Swift Assist seems to have paid dividends, assuming you can get it to work. I did open up Hyperspace on Tahoe in the Xcode beta. It would not build, so that doesn't bode well, but I'll figure it out.
overall impressions, though. I mean, for me, the iPad stuff was the star of the show for me. I am really, really, really excited about it. As stated earlier, I'm tentatively excited about the new design changes. I don't love it at all right now, but I really do think they're heading in the right direction. Everything else, it was good. I mean, there were no particular surprises, but it was good, and I'm looking forward to this, to getting to work on it, even though I'm also kind of dreading it. And I'm very excited to see what WWDC brings, which, by the way, I think, and I haven't looked into this, but it sounds like they may have dropped all the videos already. Is that right? Do we know?
Couldn't tell. Like, I know why people are saying that, because I saw it in the developer app too, but I didn't try downloading like one of the later ones.
All right, well, no worries. Either way, overall, I think this was certainly not my favorite WWDC, but it was decent. It was especially good given how in the doldrums all of us felt and kind of still feel. But I thought this was pretty good. Let's start with Marco and then end with John. Overall impressions and or final thoughts.
I mean, yeah, I wasn't expecting any changes to the developer relationship, and we didn't get any. But we got what we hoped we would get, which is a huge upgrade to the on-device AI APIs and a system redesign. the system redesign, I think we were all going into it like a little bit like, you know, I don't know about this. And I think it has proven to be warranted that the system redesign really goes very far in a certain very opinionated direction. It's going to hopefully have some revision over the course of the summer. And we are indeed going to have to do a ton of work in our apps to adopt it. It's going to be an incredibly busy summer just to keep up with the redesign, not even considering all the new APIs and stuff like that, just getting our apps to, you know, fit in, not look broken and not look old with the new system design is going to take the entire summer. And that's all we're going to be able to do for most of us, if we care about design, at least. so that's going to be a lot. And there's going to be a lot of drama over the summer as the design is hopefully tweaked. If it's not, God help us all. But if it is tweaked, or you know, maybe things like, you know, tab bars might become usable. Right now, they are definitely not. Please don't use the new tab bar in your apps unless it really changes. But anyway, it's going to be a very busy summer. They delivered what appears to be very, very strong technical advancements in ways that will give a lot of us a lot to do, even after we, you know, fix the design. So we're going to be busy, and I think I'm very much looking forward to what I'm going to be able to do with these new APIs. They look, again, very promising. I think I can do some really cool features with them once I finish all my design work.
John?
I think WWDC keynotes, at least, maybe not all the sessions, but keynotes are kind of at the point where the same point that iPhones are, where basically everything leaks. Like, you got all this information ahead of time. It's almost, I think in past years they've said basically like, oh, someone who had access to the deck, here's all the things they're going to talk about. So there's not so many surprises these days, but it's in the details to see what they're going to be like. I was most pleasantly surprised by iPadOS. I like the direction it's going. All the nitty gritty about the technical stuff that's in the sessions, that's always fun. I always enjoy that. Everything just always gets better. We'll talk about that in future episodes, I'm sure. But for the keynote stuff, the redesign, which was sort of the star of the show as far as I was concerned, with the exception of the terrible tab bars, which I think are terrible for additional reasons above and beyond the animation and the appearance, just like conceptually, I think it's a bad idea. I think I'm okay with the redesign on iPhone and iPad. Granted, I haven't installed there, but in all the things that I've seen, I'm like, yeah, it could have been worse. Like, you know, again, tab bar aside, everything else I think will be fine. On macOS, first of all, I would say, again, if I were writing a review, this is the most significant redesign of macOS since Aqua. I don't think it's even close, right? It is so, like, if you look at, for example, from 10.15 to 10.2, you're like, oh, this is a big change, but they did it in little steps. We didn't really have this big discontinuity of, like, totally new thing. Like, they got rid of the pinstripes, they got rid of the translucency, they got rid of the color, they darkened it up, they added a little bit of leather, they removed the leather, they lightened it up, they darkened it up, they smoothed it out, they added a little bit of vibrancy, like, small steps over years and years. This is a break. We have a totally new idea. Everything is up for grab. Everything changes. I don't like how it looks. I think it's too bright. I think the contrast is too low. I think it's ugly. I don't like how it works in certain areas. I don't like the way the things like the dock show windows that are going behind them. It looks busier than it used to be. I don't like the new menu bar. The new finder icon is hideous and they need to fix it. I don't like the round rect jail that they're putting all the stuff in. It is clear to me now, playing with it for even just an hour, that eventually all the old macOS will look ancient and this will look new, because whenever you have a big break, that's true. But of all the OSs, I don't know if this surprises me or it just fills my worst expectations, I like the new design the least on macOS. Like, you guys haven't explored it yet, but let me tell you, there's tons of stuff in there. They've changed so many things, and also apps that are on your Mac right now that are not built against the Tahoe SDK, like pre-existing apps, just everything in them is different. And I understand they do that for compatibility, which is good, but like, all my apps have pop-up menus, like the buttons pop-up menus, like every control looks different in old apps and new apps, even in places where they don't seem like they do, because like the button metrics haven't changed, but the button appearance is different. So you're faced with, am I going to fully liquid metal my app and put conditional code in, because by the way, the metrics have changed on a bunch of stuff too. Like, I just launched a bunch of my apps and like the metrics have changed enough that things that used to not scroll do scroll, and things that were pixel aligned are no longer pixel aligned. It's worst case scenario. And like, I would be happier to do that if I really like the end result. Boy, once I get my app updated for a liquid metal, whatever, it's going to look awesome, but I don't think it does. It doesn't mean that in 10 years that I won't be perfectly happy with how the Mac looks, but this is going to take some getting used to, and I'm not really excited. What it's making me do is appreciate how my Mac looks now, because after so many years, things are boring, but like consistent and better in almost every functional way than the new thing they're introducing. Yes, the new thing looks newer, and the old things will look old, and it will look dated, but that's just because it's a change. I'm not sure there's any place in the new look that I think is functionally better than the old way. Yet. I haven't dug into all of it yet. And that's disappointing to me, because the Mac is my favorite platform, and I really wish I liked what they had done with the Mac more. And I have little faith that they're going to change much of anything. I do hold out some hope that they'll fix the Finder icon, because, hey, it's not just an icon, and they can fix it, and the new one is hideous. But everything else, I'm like, there's no time. They don't care about macOS. They're not going to change this. So in that respect, I'm a little bit down, because my favorite platform is bad. But everything else, I think, is a thumbs up.
Well, wait till you use the iPhone version.
In the screenshots, it looked fine to me. But we'll see.
A lot of it is fine. It needs a lot of work, and it's very early and rough.
Oh, yeah, and everything's broken. Like, when you turn off, like, if you turn on reduced transparency on the macOS, I tried to take a screenshot of it, but it's one of those drawing glitches that you can't screenshot. Things blink on your screen at, like, 30 frames per second, like, flashing regions of posterization. It looks like your computer's about to explode. Like, it is grim. Like, it's just the first beta. Who cares? Like, I'm just saying, like, there are bugs in this beta that I have never seen before. Like visual, it's almost like your graphics card is overheating. Somebody think that the OS is going to try it. Solve Tahoe and something, open accessibility, have a bunch of windows open, and start toggling those switches and dragging windows around. It is madness. But those are just bugs. But I'm saying, like, even when everything's working perfectly, I don't like it. So it's a contest. Will I be ranting on this show for the next 5 years about the tab bars in iOS, or will I be ranting about everything in macOS? We'll see which will win.
Oh, no.
All right, is that it?
Yep.
All right. Thank you to our sponsors this week, Delete Me, BetterHelp, and Click for Sonos. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about just the other day, Apple published a paper on the limitations of LLM reasoning technology. We're going to talk about that in Overtime. You can hear that and everything else we've done. If you join us, be a member at atp.fm/join. Thank you so much, everybody, and we'll talk to you with probably a mountain of follow-up next week.
Briefly, before we get to the after show, or maybe this is the after show, I want to read you the message that Xcode put out when it refused to compile my unmodified application.
Oh, gosh.
And I want to tell you, I want to ask you if you've ever seen this message before. Because for all I know, it's an existing message and I just don't know what it means, but it's one of those. So please help me. Conditional conformance of type blah to protocol layout does not imply conformance to inherited protocol sendable. That is an error that it won't compile. And this is not in my code, it's in third-party code. So I can't even change it. But I've never seen that message before.
Hmm. I mean, I feel like we could parse out what they're saying, but I don't think I've ever seen it.
So the conditional conformance is like, you know, layout where content equals empty view. It's conditional conformance to protocol. So it's the layout protocol, right? So that all makes sense. But it's saying that does not imply conformance to the inherited protocol sendable. Like, okay, is that a problem that means you won't compile my code? Like, or again, this is third-party code. So I hope this library updates, because I literally can't build my app. And I didn't touch anything. I didn't change to Swift 6.2. Like, maybe I have to change it. Maybe it defaults to Swift. Anyway, I haven't had time to look at this, but that is slightly distressing to me, because I just assumed it would build out of the box if I just...
Mine did. Of course she did. We can explore that if you want, but honestly, I don't care, because we didn't get a chance to talk about the one thing that I want to talk to you about, John. And this was in the State of the Union, to be fair. And I know we're not really talking the State of the Union, but I cannot resist. This is the last release for Intel. Apparently, Tahoe is all you get. Then your cheese grater will float up to the attic in the sky. And by that, I mean the attic above your head. So we don't need to belabor it too much since we were running very long already. But in short, what's the plan, man?
I'm perfectly happy with that. Like, we talked about this on, I think, last episode. Mm-hmm, I was pleasantly surprised that Tahoe will support my Mac. That's all. Like, I mean, they've already gone longer than I thought they would have. You know, again, if they had followed the past procedure, they should have ended support in 2024, and they didn't. They didn't end in 2025. They're not going to end it until next year. So I'm perfectly fine with that. And it's nice. I really appreciate. This is not sorry. Every time I say this, I think people think I'm being sarcastic. I appreciate the fact that they announced this year that next year they're going to do this thing, which is not something they usually do. They don't have roadmaps, and and honestly, they don't even usually make that decision. Like, they could make that decision, but they've made the decision already that they made the decision that Tahoe will support my Mac. Love it. Great. All the things aside about me not liking Tahoe, but, you know, anyway. And the next one won't. So now you can make your, now you can plan. Now you can be like, okay, I can start thinking about what I'm going to replace this. If I care, if I need the, you know, like, it lets people plan. It's the thing that people always complain about Apple, that, you know, Microsoft and other PC companies would give you a roadmap. They would say, this year we're doing this, next year we're doing that, here's when we're going to drop support for this. Even with deprecations, Apple's like, oh, this thing is deprecated, and it might go away sometime in the future, and it might last a decade, or next year it might be gone. Right? And they never tell you, because they don't know. Like, they put off the decision, like a teenager, and just, like, procrastinate and say, oh, I don't know. And then at the last second, they decide. But here, they made a decision a year early, and I really appreciate that. It would have been nice if they tell me what the deal is with the Mac Pro sometime before this year ends. But, again, hardware WWC is not really a thing. So here I am, patiently waiting for them to do something, anything with the Mac Pro. Even if they cancel the Mac Pro, that would give me some information. I'd be like, I need a little bit more information before I can make the decision about what my next Mac will be. That's all.
Well, I'm glad you're this chipper about it. And I think you should be. I don't think there's any reason to be.
Yeah, depressed, I mean, don't you think it was nice of them? And
yes,
I think,
yes.
I think it's a, you know, I'm just so excited that because if it didn't support Tahoe, I'd be like, well, great. The new OS isn't going to support my Mac, and I have no idea what to buy because they haven't told me about the Mac Pro, what the deal is with that. But I don't have that problem, so I'm happy.
All right. Titles. Let's see. Preemptively squirkle myself is good.
I love You Go to Squirkle Jail. That's really good.
I think that's my favorite, but I suggested it.
There were a bunch of other good squirkle ones, too. I also liked They Insist on Squirkle.
Yeah, that's good. Naked Robotic Menu Bar is a little obvious, and I suggested it, but it is also good.
Yeah, it's got to go. It's got to be Squirkle Jail, I think.
I think you're right.
You like that better than Round Wreck Jail?
Yes.
Yeah.
You go to Squirkle Jail. Sure. Your icon goes to Squirkle Jail. I honestly really want to dive into, like, are they detecting that, like, are the edges of my Squirkle heart, how do they know that my icon is already a Squirkle? Right, like, because I use the, well, I didn't, Icon Factory use the Apple templates, like Apple gives Photoshop templates for the Squirkle on macOS. Maybe they're using that, but it's like, it's anti-alias masked. Like, are they doing, like, fuzzy logic to say, looks like this icon's already Squirkle? Because I think they do, they don't just show you Squirkle icon, I think they put, like, the highlights on the edges to make it look glassy. Like, I think that's an overlay that they put that on your existing Squirkle. It's, the icon situation, like, so much, it's such a mess on the Mac. I'm telling you, like, you guys need to install this on something just so you can look at it and prepare yourself. This is what you're going to be. It's pretty grim.
I don't think I want to. I think I'd rather be happy.
Like, I just put in the relay channel when we were sending the things. Like, I almost feel like I have snow blindness from looking at the screen. So you need the snow blindness glasses with just, like, a little slit in them. Or, like, because everything is white and low contrast and floating and rounded. And there's layers of floating on top of floating on top of floating. All right, you go to Squirkle Jail. Sure, I'm fine with that.
And yeah, and we'll see, like, you know, how much editing happens in the summer. Like, you know, how strong is Apple's product leadership? Like, that's the question. It's like, who can tell Alan Dye's team to change stuff?
No one's going to get him to change that stupid floating tab bar. I think the stupid Finder icon has the highest chance of changing, because it's like, well, we make new icons all the time. But that's the least of my problems, although it is hideously ugly. But, like, so much in macOS, I'm like, this cannot be it. Like a volume slider, for example, have you seen, do you remember what that looked like from the keynote? You probably don't remember. You probably blocked it out. Like, any kind of slider, like the, I don't know, let me find one. And
Yeah, well, now they're flat. Like, I have my speed control in Overcast looks terrible because now, like, I mean,
no,
obviously,
in Mac OS, I'm talking about in Mac OS.
Oh,
I mean, fine. Like, where's their slider in system settings? Maybe in sound. Let's see, sound.
Yeah, the input levels.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I guess it's not that bad, but like, it's ugly when it's just sitting there in front of you. When you grab it, it turns transparent and it looks like a piece of glass. That's not the objectionable part. I think just like the lozenges. Anyway, please, both of you, install macOS on something if you possibly can, because we need to talk about it next week because it's
can you
good.
Put it on an external?
That's why I was freaking out today. I'm like getting this extra time.
Yeah, I'll plot an old laptop.
So much easier to put OSs on things when they ran on Intel, like when I was going to be using them. And I know this one does run on Intel, but like, I'm not going to put it on my Mac Pro, and all my other Intel Macs are no longer supported. And so I have to install the ARM version. And I'm like, for a while, the beta profile wasn't showing up for me. So I got the IPSW. I could not figure out how to put that on. I put a Mac into DFU mode. I use Apple Configurator. I drag the IPSW onto it. And it's just like, it could never get it to work. Thank God, finally, the beta profile came through and I could just switch the beta profile and do software update. But yeah. And that's on the intro. I'm not entirely sure how to do it on the external. I wish what they used to give you is the .app installers that you get from the App Store, because then you could just pick external drive and install it on it, and it worked fine. But those days are long gone.
All right. Let's go to overtime. We will cut off the live people. Thank you, live people, for being live. We had many of you. We even had the Twitch stream up for the mirroring, in which I was occasionally checking the chat, and it includes things like fart. I don't really understand Twitch culture, but hope that was fun for you. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next week.